Chapter 5. Tilly. I first met Angus Mann in Africa when I was 29 years old. When I think back to our beginning, when I open up all of the little boxes in my head and examine those memories, I re-experience Angus more than simply remember him. My career was on its way up. His, almost an afterthought. Although, to be fair, the decision of Brightleaf Films to option The Lion Tree was an unexpected shot in the arm. The Lion Tree, as a motion picture, gave Angus more public recognition in the 11th hour of his career than did all of his preceding works combined, just as I told him it would. This was a victory I lorded over him mercilessly until the very end. Angus would undoubtedly object to the term career as a characterization of his life's work, connoting, as it does, a prolonged exchange of effort and personal sacrifice for financial return. And, of course, he would be right about that. Angus never wrote for money, and for most of his life, he never had much of it. He wrote words in exchange for oxygen. He wrote to live. He wrote because, emotionally, constitutionally, he had little choice. Angus Mann wrote in his own blood. To call it a career misses the point. But back then, I was all about career, the prolonged exchange of personal sacrifice for financial return. I was then a comely sprig of single-minded ambition, tempered by emotional immaturity, disgustingly poor judgment, low standards, delusions of grandeur, and a tragic blind spot for irony. In short, perfect for Hollywood. And while I had little grasp of just why I was perfect for Hollywood, I knew in the pink of my marrow that I was perfect. I either sensed that I had all of the runaway narcissism and other tragic self-delusions required of the Hollywood perfection standard, or I believed that I had no delusions at all, and that Hollywood would reward me for my unique artistic talent as an actress, which, of course, is seriously delusional and narcissistic. So, either way, I was perfect for Hollywood. I met Angus on location filming The Lion Tree, about 2 weeks into the shoot. We were in Tunisia, working on what would be the first of three efforts to get the safari wildlife shots right. Blair Gaines directed and co-produced the picture, a first-rate movie maker, and, not by coincidence, a first-rate, hot-headed prick. I vowed in the middle of that film that I would never work with Blair again. I have broken that promise twice. I never actually had a role in any of the safari shots, but Blair was pushed for time. He wanted to work with me on my part of the script, which was in constant evolution. Angus had written Colonel Ivanova as a multidimensional character, subdued perhaps, but multifaceted. The screenwriters, I cannot remember their names, Frick and Frack, could not settle on just how to boil Ivanova down, to congeal all of her richness into a flat, marketable attitude that they could slap onto a poster. They kept tweaking and rewriting, and my part kept changing. Ivanova the siren. Ivanova the bitch. Ivanova the victim. Ivanova the scrupulous interrogator. Blair finally lost his patience, and the arguments were daily and epic. The rapid deterioration in that relationship is ultimately what led to all of the mid-production industry gossip about Blair firing the screenwriters and reworking the script himself. Not exactly true. What Blair actually did was hire Angus, already a consultant for the project. Frick and Frack quit in a huff to see their lawyers. The truth is that Blair always seemed to be in danger of shooting a scene that had not yet been fully scripted. So I spent a couple of weeks in Tunisia and Kenya, working on my part. I flew out with the crew and met Blair, who had flown over early with the advance team and the gaffers to scout the shoot. I spent most of my time sweating beneath a tarp the crew had draped over the tops of two of the larger trucks Blair had rented. Tough as I was in every other respect, I was still a girl from Ohio who had barely managed to acclimate to Los Angeles. I was certainly not prepared for the Kenyan climate. I spent my days swatting at flies, preparing for my evening sessions with Blair, and staring out into the savanna, watching them try to shoot this single scene, an enactment of the allegory that Ivanova offers to Lieutenant Miller as a way of summing him up before imposing his sentence, which was, in many ways, a centerpiece of the film. On each day, our window of opportunity was only about 3 hours. Lighting was crucial, and Blair wanted the sun to be in a particular slice of the sky. He wanted those shots to have an underexposed sepia flavor, like an old memory burned at the edges. He wanted the savanna scenes to have some visual resonance, albeit in contrast with the scene set under the enormous synthetic dome on Rutan Baker, the planet where Elena Ivanova interrogates her lover. The Rutan Baker scenes were deliberately washed out and overexposed to suggest sterility rather than age. Truth over memory. Nothing cooperated. The insects got in the way. In Kenya, the wind came in unpredictable gusts. We had generator problems. The lions were difficult. The wild lions were, ironically, far too diffident for the mood Blair was trying to capture. Zoom lenses brought them in close, but did nothing to agitate them into ferociousness. The captive lions, on the other hand, were so agitated at all the heightened attention that their handlers could not give them any workable direction. The zoo shots were, without exception, disasters. We kept having to leave civilization to find these cats in their natural habitat where they were simply too content to seem wild. But Blair got his shot. He always does. We did most of our script work at night in hotel courtyards, first in Tozeur, then in Mombasa, after Blair had worked through the dailies and lined the cast and crew out for the next day's shoot. It has been so many years now. I have never been back to Africa, and it is certainly out of the question now. But I do remember it vividly. I remember the night air was sweet and still and heavy and so hot, boiling up from the ground, it was hard to concentrate. It was as though the sun, baking the people having lunch in a park on the other side of the planet, was burning directly through miles of darkened earth to reach the soles of our feet. I remember that Angus was always nearby, always underfoot, with his tea and his cigarettes. He carried around a ragged copy of his story, either stuffed in a back pocket or rolled up like a paper scepter. He was quiet and distant much of the time, as though he were politely laboring the pain of some internal wound. Often, Angus was silent for hours on end, standing and watching or sitting and watching as people and equipment streamed around him, as though he were a rock jutting obstinately out of a river. My first impression was that he was just naturally deferential to what goes on in someone else's home. I know better now. What I saw as deference was simply a well-mannered hopelessness, a begrudging, excruciating surrender to something he loathed. When Angus did contribute, it was sudden and unpredictable, in the nature of an involuntary outburst, a violent squall in the desert. Out of nowhere, he became a torrent of vituperative opinion and strenuous objection, with no hint of deference, as though we were in his home, as though we were deigning to instruct him on composition. He spoke like a writer. His tirades had a beginning, a middle, and an end, full of metaphor and symbolism, and always rich with understated derision. We even joked to ourselves that Angus spent his hours of pained silence mentally composing his next nuanced harangue. And yet, while I call them outbursts and tirades and violent squalls and the like, the remarkable thing about such interjections was that Angus's intensity came less from his manner than from his words, and the implacable ferocity in his eyes when he spoke them. Flailing and shouting were beneath him, and often, even when he chose to sacrifice all economy of verbal expression, speaking great rivers of words in service to some depth of feeling, he almost always adhered to a preternatural economy of emotional expression. One had to watch and listen to understand Angus. It took me a long time to realize that his many harsh opinions were merely steam vents miles away from the molten core. In retrospect, I have to say that Blair showed remarkable tolerance and concern for Angus's opinions, an odd solicitude that increasingly upset the screenwriters. Knowing Blair, angering the screenwriters may have been the point. I remember how strangely territorial I was, how protective of the art of making movies, how I resented the incursions from this force of literature, this man, the author, who had made no bones about his disdain for the industry, my industry, at whose doorstep he laid nothing less than the downfall of all Western civilization. I took my cue from the crew and the screenwriters who, by the end of the shoot, truly hated Angus. Probably because they could not tell from one moment to the next whether the burning sensation at their backs was the Tunisian sun or his scathing judgment. Blair, on the other hand, treated Angus like a father. Angus, in return, treated Blair like a wayward son who had chosen to bring home a hooker as his bride. One evening in Kenya, I left Blair in the courtyard, berating the screenwriters for devoting two valuable days to entirely transforming Lieutenant Miller's motivations into something actively homicidal. They had actually concocted a frantic chase through the center of Rutan Baker and grafted on an explosive, dome-shattering ending, none of which has any counterpart in Angus Mann's original short story. Angus was so angry, his lips grew visibly tight and his color seemed to redden. When the writer suggested that The Lion Tree was just too dull to adapt to the screen without something to offer younger male viewers, Blair nearly had a coronary infarction, giving full voice to what Angus must have been feeling. I knew the rest of the evening was shot, and so I simply pushed myself back from the table and left the four of them to fight it out. The moon was enormous and singed to a burnt saffron. I walked the maze of dirt pathways, flanked by high shrubbery, designed to serpentine ridiculously around the hotel grounds. They were artificially Byzantine, confusion where there needn't have been confusion. I remember not expecting such artifice in a place like Africa. But then, who was I to complain of artifice? I stopped for a while at the Elephant Fountain. The brochures in the lobby had made it look much larger than its actual size, which approximated that of a large horse. I held the back of my neck under the stream, arching up from the wrinkled stone trunk. The water ran over me in warm, soft gushes. It felt so good that I could not resist soaking my hair. I closed my eyes. The water filled my ears as though I had dived into the sea. So I didn't hear him the first time he spoke.
I said, "You must wonder why you ever got involved in this project."
Angus was looking up at the moon, blowing smoke out into the evening. Wisps of it curled back around over his hand, taking temporary refuge in his short, silvery beard. I could tell he was still agitated, and surmised that he must have left the table to keep from doing physical violence. I twisted my hair into a thick rope, wringing water into the dirt. "I guess Blair knows what he's doing. He's an ass, but he's pretty good."
"Slept with him yet?"
"Hey, fuck you." Ivanova the bitch speaking, cold and unruffled. I was young and thick-skinned and tough as nails. I sat on the edge of the fountain and combed through my hair with my fingers.
"Just asking. Your reputation precedes you, I'm afraid."
"That's none of your business." He trailed off, pretending to withhold judgment. I should have let it go. "What?" Angus shook his head, as if to dismiss the subject. "What, Angus?"
"It may be none of my business, as you say."
He considered his cigarette.
"But it would seem that you talk rather freely of your escapades to anyone who will listen. Is there someone in particular you hope is listening? Because you can always just pick up a telephone."
"You're putting a lot of trust in tabloids. Most of it's shit."
"If you say so."
"You're not exactly my confessor."
"No, just a fellow Ohioan. One who can see how far you've fallen."
"Look, I don't need the morals lecture. You wrote a nice little story. Blair will spin it into gold, and we can all sell ourselves out all the way to the bank."
"This is not my choice,"
he said after a long silence. "I think it is your choice."
"It isn't."
"Then why'd you sell the rights? Was it optioned at gunpoint or something?"
"I wrote it 43 years ago,"
he said calmly. I know now that he must have been holding back the bile rising in his throat beneath those words.
"When I was younger than you are now, back when I knew as much about publishing and intellectual property rights as you do now, apparently."
"If you say so," I responded with just enough insouciance to rub it in. "You have another one of those?" Angus lit me a cigarette and we staked out different areas of the clearing that surrounded the fountain to look at the sky and blow smoke at the moon.
"Your family still in Ohio?"
he asked eventually. "My parents and two brothers."
"And what do they think of your meteoric rise?"
I took a long drag and thought about that one. "I don't believe they're of one mind on the subject."
Not everybody is so proud of waltzing Matilda."
"Tilly."
"As you wish."
Mom's proud. She was nervous at first, but she's busting now. Dad thinks I'm a floozy. We don't talk much. He's read some of your stuff, though, so maybe my approval ratings will go up with him after this movie.
Don't bet on it.
Then there's David. Basically supportive, but I think he likes to look down his nose at the whole Hollywood scene. Not real social, my brother.
Attaboy, David.
Please. David is just envious that I got out and made something of myself. He's a high school history teacher at his old high school.
And does he harbor some secret envy for his sister, the celebrity, notwithstanding his more reasonable disdain?
Maybe. I give him some cachet in the classroom.
Living as a derivative of his kid sister. That's gotta feel good.
Hey, not my fault. Dave's not the boldest guy you'll ever meet.
I rolled my eyes, thinking of my brother. Thinking of the hell he had just survived. If he had, in fact, survived. I had not been in touch with my mother since leaving for Africa, and the events now unfolding back home were still in my head. In fact, all of a sudden, my entire family seemed to be in fresh turmoil. David, my mother, and my father, each in their own separate upheavals. Everyone but Ben, who was as steady as ever. It was as though Columbus had been sitting atop an active volcano and no one had known it until a week before I had boarded a plane for another continent.
What about the other brother?
I recall not liking that he was taking an inventory. I did not like feeling examined, particularly by a writer. Tossing red meat to the tabloids was one thing. But discussing my family with someone who had the ability and professional compulsion to look deeper, to make subterranean connections, to actually understand. It was as unsettling as talking to a psychiatrist. But I also felt some lingering remorse for calling him a sellout, twisting the knife with which I knew he had stabbed himself. So I answered.
My younger brother is Ben. No concept of me as anything other than his big sister. Cares nothing one way or the other about the celebrity. He'd care if I played quarterback for the Buckeyes.
Attaboy, Ben. I think I like the men in your family.
What about your family? Are they all as cheerful and outgoing as you are?
It was a snotty question intended to cut off his interrogation. I had no idea at the time how much that question must have sliced through him until it dug into bone. He did not answer, and I took his silence as a victory, although I must have had enough sense to leave it there and not push him further.
Has anyone told you that you look a little like Robert Forrester?
I asked, letting him off the hook.
Only with a beard.
Yes.
Angus turned and smiled wryly at me through a cloud of smoke.
And all of those people are quite gruesomely dead now, so...
I choked back a laugh, not wanting to give him that satisfaction.
Well, tell me this. If you could choose any actor to play you in a movie about your life, who would it be?
He was silent so long, I thought he wouldn't answer.
Gregory Peck.
Gregory Peck is dead.
Precisely.
Come on. Your life's not that dull. You're in Africa, Angus. With a major director making a movie out of your own book.
Story.
Story, whatever. You should be really pumped up about this.
Have you even read it?
Of course I've read it. Like, maybe 6 times.
What did you think?
I am doing the movie, aren't I?
Oh, is that the litmus test? You also did the Cat House Diaries.
It was payback for asking about his family. It was my turn to nurse the silence.
Give me a break, I said finally. Steinkruger was a crappy director, working from a crappy script.
But you sure are great in the old sack.
I told you to leave that alone. It was a long time ago.
Just over 36 months ago, if I'm counting right.
And I suppose you don't even care about Peppermint Grove.
Why should I?
It was nominated for a Sundance Audience Award, and I was nominated for a special jury prize for dramatic acting.
So?
So, that was my breakthrough role. It launched me. I'm not bragging.
No.
No. I'm just saying, why focus on the Cat House Diaries instead of Peppermint Grove? Unless you just want to tear me down.
I'm not trying to tear you down,
he said.
It was an improvement.
An improvement? That's all?
You didn't win, did you?
On my first nomination ever? No, I never said I was Meryl. He picked a leaf from the hedge and examined it before letting it drop.
On a first name basis with Meryl, are we?
He took a long drag, looking at me out of the corners of his eyes, and then away again. I knew then that this was as close as Angus ever got to enjoying himself. I looked down into the fountain, mumbling. We've met. Once. So?
That wasn't a very friendly thing you said about her at the premiere.
I was misquoted. I apologized.
You called her a pig.
I did not call her a pig. I said that she could transform herself into a farm animal if the script called for it. I was complimenting her acting ability.
I don't think she understood.
Clearly, I told you I apologized. We laughed about it.
Maybe she was acting.
I thought you don't follow Hollywood. Angus turned his back again and looked up into the sky, exhaling up into a cloud of insects thrumming over the high shrubs. I could still hear the top notes of Blair's angry voice in the distance, his words indiscernible over the splashing water and the chorus of cicadas. I flicked an ash and started my way out of the clearing.
I don't follow Hollywood.
He was staring at me through the fountain, eyes flashing in the moonlight.
Hollywood follows me, and I wish it would stop.
He did not want me to leave him. There was something desperate buried in his tone that I would only recognize later. Had I known him then like I eventually came to know him, with an insider's guide to his words and his inimitable rhythms, I would have known that leaving was not an option. The sound of Blair's screenwriters hacking up his story with dull axes was still pounding in his ears. His free-floating disquiet still needed bleeding. Experience eventually taught me that the subject of discussion never really mattered to Angus. Hollywood and the cult of celebrity was as good a topic as anything else. Politics. The economy. War. The weather. As long as someone was there to listen to him rail at the broken world, or, more accurately, at his broken life within it. It was a kind of colic. Eloquently verbal and noetic, but a kind of colic nonetheless. He did not want to be left alone with himself.
It took a long time for me to realize that about Angus. It was a very inconvenient problem for a man whose greatest wish was always to be left alone.
Oh?
I turned. Hollywood follows you.
Yes. I am stalked by your teasers and your trailers and your premieres and your gossip and your silly masturbatory awards shows and your contagion of relationships, if you can call them that, forming and disintegrating and reforming, passing each other around like dirty needles. It's like being forced to sit on the edge of a giant petri dish.
His tone was measured, pulling hard against the leash, but never out of control. It is odd that there was ever a time in which his resonant voice and his way of speaking was new to me. I eventually came to understand that, with few exceptions, Angus emoted with his words, not his tone. The words may have been incendiary, but the tone was civil and restrained. He spoke as if he sensed some danger in fully letting go, as if he knew that his feelings were too much for mere words, those tiny implements of his profession. And yet, he let the words carry as much of his burden as they could, like little shovels digging into a mountain. I took a seat on the fountain wall and watched him work.
The entire Western Hemisphere is transfixed, Matilda. Locked into spellbound stupefaction at the great American bacchanal that is a day in the life of a Hollywood star. Our entire cultural race, Undetra, is one great big slobbering, sycophantic, orgiastic pilgrimage to the front window of Spago's.
Spago.
Spago. Pardon. Spago.
The word came out with a breathless flourish, and Angus genuflected.
Spago. Spago. The place where we mash our foreheads up against the glass window until it hurts and we weep with gratitude at the sight of some tarted up teenaged silicone-enhanced gynroid poking at her salad and complaining about the burden of fame.
He took a drag, exhaled, pointed moonward as if making a resolution.
You know, I think if I hear one more coke-addicted waif simpering to a live studio audience or whining out an interview to a magazine on whose cover she is splayed in some barefooted, freshly fucked pose about how difficult it is to be a star, or regaling us with tales from the rehab clinic, or bemoaning the sacrifice of privacy for the sake of the public, I may just do something violent.
You don't seem like the type, I said.
I'm not, but you're driving me to it.
Me? What did I do?
Not you, Matilda. You, Hollywood.
What did I, Hollywood, ever do to you?
Nothing, except try to misappropriate every moment of my life. You lay fraudulent claim to the rest of us. You lay claim to our dreams and aspirations. You lay claim to our past and our future. You claim our reality.
No, I don't.
Yes, you do.
He dismissed me with the wave of a hand. How?
How? The movies are a pay-as-you-go interpretive machine for living. They deign to tell us what everything we have ever done meant to us, and what everything we have yet to do will mean to us. They homogenize. They orchestrate. They brainwash. Until we all want the same things and hate the same things and orbit the same asininely juvenile standards. They tell you how to act when you catch the pop fly to win the big game. Or how to propose marriage. How to suspect infidelity and how to respond to it. Not to mention how best to inflict that sort of romantic perfidy on someone else. How to quit your job. How to smoke. Drive. Flirt. Cry. Dress. Dance. Argue. Hollywood tries to pre-sell me every sexual experience of my life, from my first kiss to my last septuagenarian Viagra-assisted erection. There is no longer any virgin experience, Matilda.
Tilly, I corrected to no discernible effect.
It's all in the can. We've seen it all before.
I do not know, all of these years later, if I have forgotten his words, or if I had allowed my attention to wander, listening to his even baritone and the soft splash and burble of that fountain. I do recall tumbling down the rabbit hole of memory as he spoke, landing into an amalgam of diatribes belonging to my father, who was far less able than Angus to keep his emotions from overflowing the tiny cups of his words. His were diatribes devoted to entirely different issues, of course. Issues concerning my teenage associations, activities, appearance, an unfavorable comparison to my older brother, and my general lack of direction. All of which are topics I still associate with half-eaten food on cold dinner plates and the image of my mother, marmoreal and frozen, over her placemat on the dining room table of my childhood home.
There is a script, you see, and we all have our recycled parts to play. We subsist on a diet of pre-digested experience. Life in this culture is all but a preconceived notion. Living should be our rebellion, but we no longer live our own lives, Matilda. We live through celluloid.
Not that my father would have disagreed with a single word of what Angus was saying. I suspect he would have stood and applauded had he too been there beneath that Kenyan moon. But my father's harsh opinions of the entertainment culture and its corrosive effects on the idealized America that he carried around in his wallet like a family photo did not develop until I was out of the house and long beyond his control. He developed those harsh opinions solely in reaction to my abrupt exodus from the Holy Lands of Ohio. Had I washed up on the shores of Broadway rather than the shores of Hollywood, my father would have spent his days railing against the moral failings of Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein and their corrosive effect on modern culture. And he still would have cursed me for throwing my life away.
We do our damnedest to approximate your life, or at least the life you pretend you're living. Your life in a fantasy world that does nothing to respect the difference between acting and living, real and make-believe. We look to you, Matilda.
Tilly.
You and your fellow demigods for our emotional template.
So the tumble down the rabbit hole of memory was occasioned not by a common subject, so much as a common tone. It was, I think, the undertone of disapproval, a barely contained disdain for me, that connected Angus back to my father in my own mind. This was a disdain much larger and deeper than any particular issue under discussion.
a disdain that used all of the smaller issues as proxies and camouflage.
You, who have no genuine life of your own except to demean yourself by chasing after my adulation in the hopes of validating your supercilious pretension and further enticing me into emulating your make-believe existence. It's positively diseased.
I think you've stereotyped the whole industry, I told him, snapping back into the present.
No.
He made a tisking sound and wagged his finger.
Don't complain to me about stereotypes. The industry, how I loathe that phrase, is nothing but stereotypes. Hollywood eats, drinks, breathes, and excretes stereotypes. The very lifeblood of the industry is one big technicolor surround sound patchwork quilt of stereotypes.
So art imitates life.
That old saw? You disappoint me.
Doesn't it?
No. Art apes life. Art comments on life. Art editorializes. Art always has an opinion. Art simplifies and exaggerates life. And then do you know what happens?
He waited for a beat. I shrugged.
It is life that begins to imitate art. Life begins preening in art's funhouse mirror. Life becomes infatuated with its own distorted image. And then art, rather liking its power over life, further simplifies and exaggerates life as it morphs headlong into parody. Before you know it, life has become a cartoon reality, while art, such as it is, has become the real reality. It's as if Narcissus's own reflection pulled him into the water, drowned him, and then crawled out, toweled off, and set out to murder the townspeople.
Christ, Angus, I said, mesmerized. You're certifiable.
Of course I am. The inmates are now running the asylum, and everyone else is inside wondering what the hell happened.
Why don't you just...
What?
I don't know, go live in your own little world with all of your authentic, rational fellows. Fly the flag of virgin experience. Don't pay attention to the movie industry. Leave us alone, and we'll leave you alone.
If only we could. The war is over. We've already been assimilated. There's no more distinction between your industry and our world. 80% of what we know comes from what we are spoon-fed by the industry.
Before the age of 12, the average boy has learned how to fight, how to fuck, and how to get high. He has seen every act of violence you can imagine and some you can't. He has already started to form a system of values around the infantile notion that the earth, its environments, and its inhabitants exist entirely for his own convenience. You should be concerned, for instance, that the average 12-year-old boy is well on his way to forming very entrenched beliefs about the value of women as objects of his entertainment and gratification.
I lost my composure at this point, laughing less at the prospect of being sized up and ogled by a hedonistic 12-year-old, and more simply at the absurdity of the unbidden, softly spoken diatribe to which I was being subjected.
Sure, go ahead and laugh. But most kids today know more about firearms and buying a hooker than they do about literature. Everyone knows how to tie a tourniquet on their own arm so that they can isolate a vein for a heroin injection.
We could do it with our eyes closed, because we've seen it so many times.
And yet, how many of the same people know how to write a coherent paragraph? How many know a single word of Joyce, or Faulkner, or Miller, or Hemingway?
But every child knows that freebasing has nothing to do with baseball. Don't you find that just a little disturbing?
What percentage of 11-year-olds do you think would be able to find Africa on a map?
I have no idea, but if you're looking to Henry Miller as a more wholesome...
I don't know either.
But I'll bet it's a lot less than those who can tell you what a 9mm is, or how to screw the neighbor's wife on the staircase, or just how to go about wiping down a crime scene.
Children conspire to work their parents over for boob jobs and Botox injections before they can even drive. And who can blame them? They're anticipating the golden age.
The golden age.
The 18 to 26 demographic that rules the world. The demographic to which we are enslaved. The demographic to whose prurient and narcissistic sensibilities we pander at every turn. We want to look like them, act like them, and think like them.
There is no higher value, we are told every minute of every day, than being 25 years old, with the hair and the teeth and the abs and the glow of shamelessness. We are the most youth-obsessed culture on the planet.
Looking older than 26 is almost a mark of shame. You're better off with cholera. You know why?
Let me guess. But Angus did not let me guess.
Hollywood. That precious film industry of yours. You're part of an infernal machine that manufactures an ooze that sticks to everything. It's like a bad commercial jingle you can't get out of your head. And you know who programs the machine? 16-year-old boys. Not literally. Literally speaking, the machine is programmed by corporate execs keenly attuned to the preferences of 16-year-old boys and the enormous market of moviegoers who share the emotional maturity and intelligence of 16-year-old boys. As a result,
he held up a hand and started counting on his fingers.
We are nurturing a culture on recreational drugs, explosions, fast cars, short skirts, mounds of silicone, soulless, self-centered ambition, and shallow, exploitative relationships. Hollywood is shaping our world, focusing our attention.
He turned his back, swatting his hand slowly and dismissively at the night. I think genuinely wanting to be through. But then he turned, pointed at me with the two fingers holding the smoldering cigarette.
You know, I'm wrong about that. I say Hollywood is shaping our world, present tense, like it's something new. But it's been this way from the beginning. Since Steamboat Willie and the Jazz Singer. But now, after all these years of immersion in this toxic brew, the pathological self-absorption, the prurience, the contagion of personality, all boiling away on a pyre of money and lost souls, we are finally disintegrating.
Will you lighten up? They're just movies, Angus. They're not real. Take what you like, leave the rest, and get back to the real world.
Real world? What real world?
Nothing is real in our country unless it is fictionalized, given a schmaltzy soundtrack, and sold back to us at a multiplex.
We no longer have the ability to distinguish fact from the most implausibly conceived script. Our muscles of discernment have atrophied down to nothing. Hollywood has drugged us into believing that anything and everything is possible.
But all good things are possible, Angus, I said imploringly.
It was more than just a little ironic for me, of all people, to have been cast as the Penglossian naif in the conversation. Certainly my parents would never have recognized me. But then again, my early relationship with Angus Mann was always one of reaction and separation at an unconscious level, like two magnets pushing each other around a table, each of us stubbornly unwilling to turn around and face the other direction.
And who is going to do these good things, Matilda? You? We are narcotized into inaction, and we are unmoved by anything that is not a cause celeb. It is now Hollywood that focuses our attention. We care about our oceans because some movie star cares about our oceans. We care about genocide because some movie star cares about genocide.
Is that so bad? I mean, how else?
Yes,
he said flatly.
That's bad.
Why?
Because that's not really caring. Cooing over celebrities doesn't cut it. It lulls us into thinking that we care. We feel better about ourselves as we plunder the planet, but that's not caring. As soon as the celebrities move on to something else, we'll go with them. We have lost our independent hearts. We are idolatrous to the core. Think of it.
I did, or pretended to.
We can't even express a point of view without at least footnoting some movie for support. What do I think about the plight of mankind? It's like what Cornelius said in Planet of the Apes.
So then just tune it out, Angus. Tune us all out. No one says you have to
tune it out.
He smiled sardonically, pointing at me again with the glow of his cigarette.
How? There is no tuning it out. You don't tune out a brainwashing. Remember Malcolm McDowell in A Clockwork?
He dropped his cigarette calmly and stepped on it, shaking his head in disgust.
What? What is it?
You see what I mean? A fantastic book. A book, Matilda. A piece of literature written by Anthony Burgess. And do I reference the book? Do I even invoke the protagonist? No. The thought never occurs to me. And I'm a writer.
My brain is choking on celluloid. And I can only summon forth the cinematic adaptation of the book and the name of the actor who played the lead role. The book is a memory now.
A new reality has been implanted.
I never read the book, so it's just as...
Of course you didn't read the book. Your generation doesn't need to bother with books. Too much time, too complicated, all of those words and sentences. The only way to increase literacy in this country is to actually capture on film the stars and starlets, people like yourself, reading books out loud to the camera, preferably lying about naked and bleeding, and then charging people $9 or $10 to see the movie in a theater. Short of that, books are a thing of the past.
Angus lit another cigarette and blew out a long blue stream that held his interest for several seconds as it lost its integrity.
Anyway,
I prompted.
What? Malcolm McDowell.
Right. Malcolm.
With his eyelids pried open with metal clamps as he is forced to watch the equivalent of snuff films, while a nurse uses a dropper to keep his sockets moist. That is your precious Hollywood. There is no tuning it out, as you suggest. I am being forced to bear witness to the whole ugly spectacle. All of you thrusting your asses and your tits and your thighs up in my face every time I wait in line to buy a loaf of bread. God help me. If I could get a restraining order against the industry, I'd do it.
How long have you been working on this rant, Angus?
Am I ranting?
Yes. You're calm enough, but it's definitely a rant.
All right, then. My whole life. So many books people will never read because some movie maker got to it first. To Kill a Mockingbird. Of Mice and Men.
Hey, I loved those movies.
They're books, Matilda. Books.
So what if they are? They're also great movies. Can't there be both?
No. No, there cannot be both. One replaces the other. The book is ineluctably lost, and we with it.
Much ado about nothing, I said, mocking him. I can see I'm wasting my breath. I remember something of my own sublimated irritation taking over at that point, tired of absorbing him with no end in sight, tired of his words, his little shovels digging at the mountain. I get the point. I get it, okay? I have a degree in English lit, so stop assuming that I'm a moron. He didn't respond. Is that what you're so afraid of? I asked. That your precious words will be turned into images and lost? That you will become so successful as a writer that all of your books will become tempting Hollywood snacks? Are you worried about what will become of your tragic little story? He looked at me from across the clearing, his features inscrutable. Are you really too good or too smart or too pure for all of us? Or are you really just protecting your own vanity? Are you worried about your place in literary history being sullied by a band of underbred, oversexed, shallow-minded acting twits? He still didn't answer. Feeling him off balance for the first time, I kept pushing. Let me tell you something. Thanks to the movies, more people know about Jane Austen and Billy Shakespeare than ever would otherwise. More people will know your name because of Tilly Johns and Blair Gaines than for any other reason. They'll see the movie, then they'll go buy the book.
Story.
Whatever.
Hogwash.
They will.
And when they realize the story has no explicit sex scenes, no exploding dome, no harrowing chase scenes through the center of Rutan Baker.
You tell me. I demanded.
Crushing disappointment. It will ultimately turn them away from books.
You mean you? It will turn them away from you. Silence. Maybe you should spice things up a little then. Try to keep pace with modern sensibilities, Angus. Maybe Colonel Ivanova really does just need a good fuck.
Are you actually trying to prove my point?
Well, okay. I am messing with you a little. But you've got to laugh at the irony, Angus. The more successful you are as a writer, the more likely you are to have to risk the plunder of your genius by the movie industry. I'll bet you sold off the rights to more than just the Lion Tree. Am I right?
He did not answer. I could feel the shame radiating in waves from his body. I know now that he thought of those stories, 15 of them altogether, as his children, sold into slavery for the price of the rent.
And the more the movie makers take what you have written and dumb it down and spice it up, the more your stock as a writer will rise by simple virtue of the fact that more people will want to see the movie and will know who started it all. Your name will seep into the public consciousness, and the next book you write will fly off the shelves.
And why? Because they love me as a writer?
Maybe, but more likely because they love the movies that are adapted from what you have written. The written work is really just a first draft of the movie.
I remember almost making it through those last words without laughing, having no idea what I would get back. He watched me smirk, and after a moment, at last, I saw his face relax a little. Something approximating a smile passed his lips.
"Now you're talking my language,"
he said, sounding suddenly tired.
"You're still fucking with me, but at least I understand you."
"I'm just trying to get along. This is going to be a long production." I ground my long cold cigarette into the mortar of the stone wall surrounding the spewing pachyderm. "And if Blair doesn't get me a solid script, I'm going to walk. This is getting ridiculous."
The moon had climbed higher in the night, shedding its saffron for bone. I can remember Angus standing at the end of the clearing, the angles of his form softened in the darkness, his face obscured by stone and water except for, every now and then, a sheen of silvery beard and the burning tip of his cigarette. I could not tell whether he was staring at me or at the fountain between us. And even if I could tell, I would not have known what he was thinking. That level of knowledge was still too far away. It was early in the project, and I would grow to dislike him far more than I did at that moment.
"Yes. Ridiculous. On this, we agree."
He left me alone in the clearing, with water washing over the sound of his footsteps as they receded around the hedge toward the hotel. But before they were altogether gone, they stopped, and Angus was suddenly back in the moonlight.
"Let me just ask you this. What is it that you find tragic about my story?"
For a split second, I was lost in the ambiguity of that question, unaware at the time that I would eventually become lost in the answer.
"What?"
"You referred to my story as tragic."
"What, the Lion Tree? Well, isn't it?"
"I'm just asking, who's tragic?"
I thought for a moment. It was a serious question.
"Lieutenant Miller, for one, obviously. His dead wife, Jules, for another. Elena Ivanova, for a third. God, Angus, they're all tragic, aren't they?"
"What's tragic about Ivanova?"
"Well, she loves him, right? Against her better judgment, she allows herself that comfort in this extremely isolated, emotionally sparse existence. This is a military woman, which means she's not a woman, or she's not supposed to be. She's an officer. Her whole life, she has excelled by deep freezing her feelings for safekeeping. I mean, the whole cryogenic pod thing was a decent metaphor, although a little overused, if you ask me."
"It wasn't overused in 1962,
he said.
Fair enough.
You want to know why it feels overused?
I know. Hollywood.
Beating it to death in every single science fiction movie ever made.
Sorry I brought it up.
Please continue.
Right. Anyway, on the long trip out to Rutan Baker with Lieutenant Miller, Ivanova has, how to put it, allowed herself to thaw. And you get the sense she never really shows it very well. She's not used to showing her feelings. But you get the sense that the feelings run deep. But then she finds out this horrible fact about Miller. Murder. The sin of sins, and yet nothing compared to the betrayal she feels. So she snaps back into this official relationship. She's an officer again. But it's just a facade. I mean, she never really cracks. She's tough. She's ruthless. But you just know that she still loves him. She's stuck with these feelings and she can't go back. The toughness used to be her defense. That ruthlessness that she has, but now that is just an expression of her own anguish. I mean, look at the final punishment. That's fucking brutal. That only comes from serious emotional pain. That comes from love. So she still loves him, even though she knows she shouldn't.
Why shouldn't she?
Because she knows she's next.
Next what?
His next victim.
Murder?
I'm not as prosaic as you think, Angus. Don't insult me. No, not murder. Rejection.
And she loves him anyway.
Isn't that the whole point?
So she escapes?
He asked. No. That's the thing. There is no escape. How do you escape rejection? She is every bit as trapped as he is. She is tragic. She just got to have the last word. Angus was barely visible in the shadows. He was still, and I waited, nervous to have ventured my lowly interpretation of his famous story.
And so shall you have the last word tonight, Miss Johns,
he said at last.
Try your very best to go to bed alone, lest you meet a similar fate.
He turned and was suddenly gone. It was the first of many times that I would go to bed alone, with only the sound of his words pulling at the sheets.